A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 9, Being Good and Being Evil. Is Humanity Naturally Good?
In our last lecture, we explored a truly revolutionary thinker, Machiavelli. Machiavelli's successors all accepted some of his principles, especially his idea about lowering the standards and rejecting at least some of the assumptions of traditional morality. But they all made him more acceptable, more respectable, mitigated him. First, Thomas Hobbes agreed with Machiavelli's rejection of virtue as the end of human life in society, but instead of power and glory and conquest, Hobbes substituted self-preservation against the threat of violent death. And he also added a minimal theory of natural rights, though he too, like Machiavelli, was probably an atheist and a materialist. But Hobbes was still too radical to become popular. So shortly after Hobbes, John Locke modified this still more by dropping the atheism and materialism. But he too rejected virtue as the end of society and traditional morality as the necessary basis of society. And he substituted property instead as the social greatest good. Now here was a new, respectable substitute for virtue. The desire for property, which had traditionally been called a vice, greed, now became a public virtue. For under the new capitalist economy, this private vice became a public virtue. It became the profit motive, and it drove society to become richer, so that the more greedy everyone is, the richer everyone is, by a trickle-down effect. So the work ethic replaces ethics as the foundation for the good society. Where the ancients defined a good society as one that made it easy for us to be morally good, Locke defines a good society as one that makes it unnecessary to be good. Instead of doing good, the aim is doing well. And this is the society we live in today. Its reviser and rebuilder was Locke, but its first builder was Machiavelli. Today, we'll explore the question whether man is innately good or evil by concentrating on two contrasting philosophers who come after Machiavelli, Hobbes and Rousseau, his polar opposite. This lecture will be a little different in relation to the books, since neither Hobbes nor Locke nor Rousseau ever wrote a short and simple book like Machiavelli's The Prince. We'll not be referring to their books in detail, but we'll make more general overviews. Hobbes accepted Machiavelli's premise that man is by nature selfish, though he made it a bit more respectable by saying that his fundamental desire was simply to live without death, to be left alone. Hobbes also accepted Machiavelli's premise that society is artificial, and therefore justice is the result of a social contract rather than a natural law. But he made that a bit more respectable by including some notion of natural justice and natural rights. Rousseau and Hobbes seem at first to be polar opposites. Hobbes the pessimist, Rousseau the optimist. Hobbes believes man is by nature selfish and bad, and society makes him good, which is why you need a rather totalitarian society, which he called the Leviathan, the great beast. Rousseau believes that man is by nature good, and society makes him bad. Hobbes believed man created civil society in order to force himself to be good, out of fear of violent death. For in the state of nature, before the invention of civil society by this social contract, life was nasty, poor, solitary, brutish, and short. Rousseau believes that man is by nature a noble savage, and that he is taught to act badly, contrary to his good nature, by society, by artificial civilization. For both Hobbes and Rousseau, society is not natural, but artificial. This is something common to the two thinkers. They're opposites, yet they share a common modern assumption that none of the pre-modern philosophers held except the sophists in ancient Greece. They both contrast the state of nature and the state of civil society. They believe that society began at a certain time in early human history when this social contract was made. Social morality is an artifice, a contract. Don't bash me on the head and I won't bash you on the head, and we'll both give up our rights to the cops or the soldiers or the king to enforce that law. We saw the origin of that idea in Plato's Republic, in Thrasymachus the Sophist. Plato disagreed with it and thought that society and social justice are both natural to man and not artificial. And almost all the pre-modern thinkers agree with Plato there, that society is natural, that it's like a body. It's often called the social body or the body politic. And therefore, it has natural intrinsic rules for its health and happiness, just as the biological body does. That's the basis of the old natural law theory of ethics. But Thrasymachus and Machiavelli and Hobbes and Rousseau all reject the natural law theory and embrace the social contract theory instead. Thrasymachus and Machiavelli and Hobbes all think man is by nature evil. Rousseau thinks man is by nature good. Now, the focus of this lecture is not going to be on the natural law theory versus the social contract theory, but rather on optimism versus pessimism, man as good versus man as evil. You may be wondering what this speculating about human nature has to do with ethics. Well, ethics is obviously for man, not for angels or animals. Therefore, it depends on what man is, on human nature, on anthropology. Not so much scientific, empirical anthropology, but philosophical anthropology. Your answer to the question, what is the moral good for man, obviously depends on your answer to the question, what is this man? And of the many, many questions within the question, what is man, one that most obviously concerns ethics is whether man is by nature good or evil, for ethics is about good and evil. So whether you are a pessimist or an optimist in anthropology is bound to make a great difference to your ethics. For instance, it will make a difference to the question of how much government you think there should be. The optimist will tend to say that government governs best which governs least. Man is good and should be trusted and left alone. Freedom should be maximized. The pessimist will say the opposite. The more government there is, the better man will behave. The same would apply not only to government, but to order in society in general. How much order and structure do we need? The optimist would tend to minimalism, libertarianism. The pessimist would want more order and structure to train the beast in us. And optimism versus pessimism about man would also make a difference to educational issues and child raising. The optimist tends to be permissive and treat the child like a flower. Let the bud unfold, Rousseau would say. The pessimist would emphasize structure and training and breaking the child's foolish and rebellious will. Another issue it makes a difference to is marriage. Can you trust people to find their proper mates? The pessimist would tend to favor arranged marriages, while the optimist would trust to natural romance. Obviously, we live today in a Rousseauian society. The question is this the true philosophy? Now, in order to try to answer the question of whether man is good or evil, we need to define our terms. There are two different kinds of goodness, and therefore of evil, which philosophers traditionally label ontological goodness and moral goodness. Ontological goodness is the goodness in your being, in your nature, apart from your will and choices and deeds and lifestyle. Moral goodness is your virtues, or your virtuous acts, deeds, choices, lifestyles. Ontological evil is worthlessness, misery, suffering, and death, the opposite of ontological good. Moral evil would be wickedness, sin, vice, the opposite of moral goodness. Ontological evil is what we are, or what happens to us. Moral evil is what we do by our free choices. To see this difference, contrast a wicked man, a spoiled genius like Adolf Hitler, with a sweet little hamster, Harry. Hitler has more ontological goodness than Harry because he's a man, and a very clever and charismatic and powerful man at that. His nature is more valuable than Harry's. But Harry is nice, not nasty. We like him, and he likes us. He makes us feel good. He cuddles. He has fewer vices, and perhaps even more virtues than Hitler, if hamsters can have any virtues. Now, since there are two kinds of goodness and two possible answers to the question of whether man is good or evil, there are four possible anthropologies. The first view is the traditional view, the classical view, both in Greek and Roman paganism, and in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and in modern personalism. It says that man is ontologically very good, very great, very valuable. For theistic religions, this is because he's created in the image of God. For paganism, he's something like a little god himself. For modern personalism and humanism, whether religious or secular, he has intrinsic rights and dignity and worth. He is more valuable than all the subhuman wealth in the world. If there were a fire in a museum and you had to choose between rescuing one old man from the West Wing and letting $1 billion worth of great paintings burn in the East Wing, or rescuing the great paintings instead of the old man, you ought to rescue the man before the paintings, because he has so much more ontological value. However, according to the traditional view, man is not morally perfect. He's a sinner. He has vices. He acts contrary to his ontologically valuable nature. And so in this traditional view, there's a lot of moralism and preaching and need for repentance and reformation. Man's vices and sins are taken very seriously. His moral badness is not tolerated, precisely because of his ontological goodness. He's the king's kid acting like an ape. He's made in the image of King God, but he acts like King Kong. As Chesterton puts it, we think too much of ourselves and too little of our souls. We're too proud of what we do and not proud enough of what we are. We're morally bad and ontologically good. Now, here's a second view. Hobbes, following Machiavelli, denies that we are ontologically that good. Like Machiavelli, Hobbes is an atheist, though he doesn't dare say so directly. In the 17th century English intellectual establishment, atheism was as politically incorrect as fundamentalism is in 20th century America. Man, for Hobbes, is not a child of God, but a shivering, naked beast, afraid of violent death, and his life is by nature nasty, poor, solitary, brutish, and short. Not much ontological dignity there. And morally, he is selfish and competitive. That follows directly from Hobbes's metaphysics. Hobbes is a materialist. He believes everything real is made of matter. So man is just a clever ape, and thought is just refined sensation, and love is just refined animal lust, and so forth. Now, matter is by nature, by its essence, competitive. Two bodies cannot occupy the same space at the same time. One has to push the other out in order to get in. The same with two human bodies. If there are two people and only enough food for one, one must die. Material goods can be shared only by being divided. So a materialistic metaphysics necessitates an anthropology of selfishness and competition. So this is a second view. Man is not very good, either ontologically or morally. Rousseau gives us a third option, that man is ontologically good and morally good, that he is a kind of God and that there is no such thing as sin. Human nature is to be trusted. Man is good. The only evil is belief in evil. The only thing to be judged is judgmentalism. The only thing to be intolerant of is intolerance. Finally, a fourth possibility would be that man is ontologically worthless but morally good, that there is no such thing as intrinsic human dignity and worth and value, and there is also no such thing as sin or vice or evil. That would be the view of Jean-Paul Sartre, who says that man and human life is meaningless and absurd and without purpose or value, since there is no God to design us and give us value. And he also says there is no sin, for we are not judged by any eternal objective moral law, but we create our own laws and values and meaning so that a thing becomes good simply by our choosing it. Our will creates morality. Morality is subjective. So this view denies both halves of the first one, the traditional view. Hobbes and Rousseau each deny only one half of the traditional view. The traditional view is that we're ontologically good and morally bad. Hobbes says we're bad in both ways, Rousseau says we're good in both ways, and Sartre says we're ontologically bad and morally good. The traditional view does not say we're totally and thoroughly bad morally. It says there's a little good in the worst of us and a little bad in the best of us. Most great novelists show us that in their characters. They show surprising moral strengths in their villains and surprising moral weaknesses in their heroes. Here's a story from that tradition that shows us its view of human nature. It's a story of how the Jews became God's chosen people. God was looking for one man to be the father of a people that he would use to be his collective prophet, his social mouthpiece to the world. But this man had to be very wise. And God knew that if a man misunderstood himself, he would certainly misunderstand God, because God had created man in his own image. So God went looking for a man who knew himself. He went first to a Platonic philosopher and gave him the job description. I'm looking for a man who knows himself to be the father of my chosen people, my chosen prophet to the world. So tell me, what is man? And the Platonist said, man is a little god, a spark of divine fire. Man is spirit. Man is immortal. Man is wisdom. Man is truth and goodness and beauty. Is that it? Asked God. That's about it, said the Platonist. Thanks very much, said God. Don't call me, I'll call you. Then God went to a barbarian chieftain and asked the same question, and the barbarian said, man is a shark, man is a wolf, man is two rows of jaws ready to spring shut on his prey. Is that it? Asked God. That's it, said the barbarian. Thanks very much. Don't call me, I'll call you. Then God found Abraham and asked the same question. And Abraham replied, "Oh, I can't be your prophet, God. I'm much too confused about myself. Sometimes I think I'm a little God, and sometimes I think I'm a little wolf. And most of the time I think I'm a whole zoo with hundreds of different animals in me, some tame and some wild, some good and some bad." "Very good," said God. "You shall be my prophet." We've already visited the issue of optimism and pessimism in anthropology when we looked at Plato's theory of education in the Meno and his answer to whether virtue could be taught in the Republic. That was a fairly optimistic anthropology. Remember, Meno began by asking Socrates, "Can virtue be taught? Or does it come by practice and habit? Or do we have it by nature? Or does it come in another way, that is, against nature?" There are four options. Pessimism says it comes only against our nature because our nature is evil. Optimism says we have it by nature. Another kind of optimism says it comes by teaching. All you have to do is enlighten the mind and the will follow. That's Plato's view. Finally, the middle view is Aristotle's, that both virtue and vice come by training and habituation and practice. By nature, we have only the potentiality for virtue or for vice, but to actualize them takes work, repeated practice, and the development of habits. I think Americans used to be closer to Aristotle, but I think today they're closer to Rousseau. If there's any one idea that's very unpopular today, it's the idea of sin, especially original sin, the innate tendency to sin, original selfishness, you might call it. Yet, if you observe how selfish little babies are, you can hardly deny this. If you thought they were innately good, you wouldn't train them out of those selfish habits. We wouldn't socialize them and tame them and train them morally. And no matter how hard we try to do that, we don't succeed very well. Even thoroughly civilized, socialized adults are far from saints. As G.K. Chesterton said, original sin is the only Christian dogma that doesn't require any faith, just newspapers. Optimism versus pessimism is not a question of personal temperament. It's a question of objective truth. It has to be settled not by your emotional preference or prejudice, but by evidence and argument and reason. So here's an attempt to use a logical argument based on evidence and experience to find out whether Rousseau is right and whether there is any innate evil in man, which he denies, and also whether Hobbes is right and whether there is any innate goodness in man, which he denies. To find out what is in man, let it come out. Give him freedom and power. It's like a chemistry experiment where a catalyst is needed to release whatever is in the chemicals. So let freedom and power be the catalysts. They're useful catalysts to find out whether there is good or evil in man because both are neutral, neither good nor evil in themselves. Freedom is the freedom to do good or evil. Freedom is not the opposite of good or of evil, it's the opposite of constraint. And the same with power. It can be used equally for good or evil. So let's see the effects on man when we give him more freedom and power and when we give him less. We don't have to make that experiment. It has been made. Modern democratic society has given us more freedom than we ever had before. And science and technology has given us more power than we ever had before, including the power of knowledge. So are we better? Are we more moral? Are we wiser? Are we happier? Are we less prone to suicide, despair, family and social breakdown, hastiness, triviality, cowardice, lust, violence, addiction? Do we call our time happy days? Compare the suicide rate in industrialized, educated, rich, powerful nations with poor nations. Compare the lyrics of popular songs 100 years ago with those today. Compare old Hollywood movies of the 20s and 30s with those today. The sophistication and the technology, the technological power, the ability to do anything on screen is vastly greater today. Is the morality better? Is the wisdom better? Is the humanity better? Is even the literary plot and characterization and theme better? One sociologist compared level of education with willingness to kill in Hitler's death camps. She expected to find that the educated were more refined and less willing to do these horribly evil deeds. She found exactly the opposite correlation. The more educated they were, the more they loved Hitler and loved to do his evil work. So it looks like knowledge and power and freedom all unlock more evil than good. It looks like Lord Acton was right when he said power corrupts. But let's do the other half of our experiment, too. Let's decrease the knowledge and education, the technology and the power and the freedom. What happened to morality during the Great Depression? What happens to morality when there is a blackout, or a hurricane, or a national emergency? People chip in and help much more than before. People act like neighbors. When suffering deprives us of freedom and power, we often act like saints. But when we get exactly what we want, when we conquer suffering, that's when we act like spoiled brats. The conclusion, it seems to me, is fairly evident that there is both surprising good and surprising evil in human nature, and that we seem to be more evil the more we get what we want: riches, leisure, power, knowledge, freedom. So that certainly seems to refute Rousseau. To summarize the argument in a syllogism, power corrupts us. Put us and power together and you get trouble. But power is neutral, not evil. Therefore, the evil must come from us. That's the bad news. The good news is another syllogism that begins with the opposite premise: suffering ennobles. But suffering is not good in itself. Therefore, the good must come from us. Too much suffering we can't take. Very few people act like saints under torture. But we do act more saintly under moderate poverty or moderate emergencies. So it seems that human goodness comes out best where there is neither too much nor too little power, money, knowledge, and freedom. In other words, middle-class virtue, which is resented bitterly both by the extreme left and the extreme right, by both the very rich and the very poor, and by both overeducated snobs and undereducated slobs. But it looks like that's the best social condition to foster moral virtue: bourgeois conditions. There's no word that the fashionable intellectuals despise more than the word bourgeois. That's the word that describes the two greatest heroes of the book that is certainly the greatest book of the 20th century, Frodo and Sam in The Lord of the Rings. They are totally bourgeois. Ordinary, humble, undistinguished, middle-class, creature-comfort-loving hobbits, and they become heroes, just like the English in World War II. Here's another argument against pessimism, an argument for innate goodness in human nature. If we didn't have innate goodness, we wouldn't know it. And if we didn't know it, we couldn't use it to judge evil by. So unless we were good, we could not recognize evil, even in ourselves. So the fact that we recognize and condemn evil in ourselves, even though we are evil, proves that we are also good. So we are both good and evil. We're good stuff gone partly bad. Here's still another argument for the traditional view that man is ontologically good and morally both good and evil. We all agree that murder, torture, rape, and cruelty are morally evil. But why? If man is not ontologically good, why is harming him so morally bad? So the next question is, what makes him ontologically good? If it's just our say-so, our choice, our desires, our will, if it's just that we love man, therefore man is good, then why is that true? If man is good just because we love him, rather than we love him because he's good in his being, if it's just subjective or arbitrary, we can change that. But we can't. Well, if it is objectively true, what's the basis for that? Why is man ontologically good? What's the origin of ontological goodness? Is it his being created in the image of God as a kind of a little god who can know truth and love goodness a bit? Or is it his having evolved from animals who can't do anything like that? Are we great because we're little gods who have fallen, or big apes who have risen? Or is it both? And if we're so good ontologically, why are we so bad morally? Why does such good stuff go so bad? Why do the best of us become the worst? The Latin saying is corruptio optimi pessima. The corruption of the best things are the worst things. As the poet says, lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds. Animals can't be as bad as we are or as good. Little children can't be as bad or as good as adults. Most of us could not be as morally bad as Hitler because we're not as clever or strong-willed as he was. Imagine if Hitler had been a saint. What a saint he would have been. The next question is, what's the origin of our evil? Well, here are some possible answers. One is that we just don't know. A second is that we're not really evil at all. It's just an illusion. A third is society's to blame. Pass the buck to them, as if society meant anything other than other people. Or perhaps it's heredity that's to blame, if we're only barely evolved apes. Another answer is Eve's excuse, the devil made me do it, or Adam's excuse, the woman made me do it. Of course, God rejected both excuses. The only other answer seems to be the most uncomfortable one. Look in the mirror. Our own free will. Well then, why did God give us free will if there's a God and he created us and he knew that we were going to misuse it so badly? Let's just assume these hypotheses for the sake of argument to get the question out. And the traditional answer is because we can't be morally good without free choice either, any more than we can be morally evil. Now, this raises a second question, beyond good and evil. The question of free choice, do we have it? Is freedom real or is it an illusion? We should look at that question, too, at least briefly, since it's an essential assumption for morality. Ancients and moderns conceive freedom differently. Freedom and free will, do they mean exactly the same thing? I think most ancient philosophers and most modern philosophers conceive freedom rather differently. The traditional view is that we are rightly praised for making good choices and for having virtues in our character, and rightly blamed for making wrong choices and for having moral vices, because that's our responsibility. We are free to make those choices. This moral judgmentalism, as moderns often call it, presupposes two things. One of them is that some choices are really morally right and really morally wrong, that there's a real objective good and evil. For if right and wrong were only invented subjective fictions, there would be no ground for praising one and blaming another any more than there would be grounds for praising one kind of fiction that you happen to like, such as fantasy, and blaming another that you happen to hate, like detective stories. The other assumption is that we are responsible for our choices, and that in turn presupposes that we have the freedom to choose, that we have free will. Now, the ancients were not always very clear on free will, but very few of them denied it. But it is denied by many scientific philosophers today who teach determinism, the view that all actions, including human actions, must be determined or caused only by necessary forces. In the case of humans, by heredity plus environment. There's also a very significant difference between the ancient and modern emphases or connotations of the word freedom. The ancients meant primarily this freedom of choice, free will, which makes us morally responsible, and that would be something inherent in human nature. We're not just animals who act by instinct. We train animals, but we don't praise or blame them. When the dog pees on the rug, we don't appeal to his conscience or tell him to go to confession. We hit him. Or spray the rug. No animal ever has free choice, and no human ever doesn't have it. Even if you're bound and gagged, you can choose to innerly agree or disagree with your captors. You can choose to hate them or forgive them. You can choose to hope or despair. As the poet said, stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Many prisoners discovered their true freedom only in prison, when every other freedom had been taken from them. Solzhenitsyn, Dostoevsky, Valadares, even Jean-Paul Sartre wrote about this. But when many modern thinkers think of freedom, they tend to think first of autonomy, not responsibility to choose, judged by and under a moral law, but the freedom to make laws, and sometimes even the freedom from laws. We tend to see laws as limiting freedom. The ancient view is that moral law defines freedom and makes freedom possible. The difference between the two views of freedom is that autonomy is something we strive for and desire, whereas free will is something we have from the start. It's part of human nature. Two obvious questions arise if we believe we have free will. How is it compatible with the fact that we are conditioned by our heredity and our environment? And how is it compatible with fate, or destiny, or divine providence, or predestination? Many modern thinkers tend to excuse bad moral behavior because they believe it was caused by society, that is, environment, or by chemistry or hormones, that is, by heredity. The ancients didn't know as much about the environment, and certainly not as much about heredity, as we do, yet most of them believed in fate or destiny or predestination, which is even a stronger force than heredity and environment, and yet they didn't usually believe that that removed free will and moral responsibility. I think we all naturally tend to believe in both free will and some kind of destiny or divine plan. because every story we ever tell has to have both those ingredients in it. A story about robots or falling raindrops isn't a story at all. To have drama, a story has to have free will and unpredictability. But a story also has to have a plot, a plan. The author has to be like God. It can't be random. The ancients tended to be satisfied believing in both of these two things, free will and fate, even if they couldn't reconcile them rationally. The moderns tend to be more skeptical, and if they can't reconcile them with clear logic, they tend to deny one or even both of them. And this makes an enormous difference for ethics. If you deny free will, you can't really judge or blame anyone anymore. There is no moral law if there is no free will. There is only compassion and tolerance and good feelings. There may be personal moral values, but no need for virtue as opposed to vice. And if you deny destiny, the other half of the paradox, then life becomes random. It's not a play with right lines and wrong lines to speak. And so again, there is no objective right or wrong. So it seems that both free will and something like destiny are presuppositions of morality. Here is how Thomas Aquinas argued for the existence of free will. He wrote, "Man has free will, otherwise all praising, blaming, rewarding, punishing, counseling, and commanding would be meaningless." To recap, what is the legacy of Rousseau and Hobbes? They're not popular thinkers in that people today would classify themselves as Rousseauians or Hobbesians. They're not satisfying thinkers, but they're very powerful and influential because each of them has questioned an assumption of the traditional view. Hobbes has questioned innate human goodness. Rousseau has questioned innate human badness. So they've opened up more options. We haven't settled on any option yet. We're certainly not in an age where there is a consensus about these issues. But they just are more confusing now than they ever were before because there are more possibilities. The main reason many modern philosophers deny free will is, in one word, science. Scientific explanations always seek necessary causes, determining causes. Scientists tend to be determinists. So in the next lecture, we will look at that problem, the relation between ethics and science. In preparation, you might want to read a little book that's not in itself about ethics, but an extremely important book for ethics, because it's the origin of all modern philosophy, Descartes' Discourse on Method.
This ends Lecture 9.